Helping people build ambitious and satisfying careers, businesses, and lives. This is the Influence Ecology Podcast. Now, here is your host, John Patterson.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm your host, John Patterson, the co-founder and CEO of Influence Ecology, the leading business education in transactional competence. Broadcasting from Ventura, California, this podcast features case studies, stories, and lessons from business owners, executives, and entrepreneurs who found real solutions, real results, and real satisfaction, not only with work, career, and money, but in every area of life. You'll hear how these ambitious professionals found that those who transact powerfully thrive. In today's episode, we'll hear some clips from our recent mid-year conference. The theme of this year was building an influence ecology. And as we teach it, there are four vital components to consider when constructing your transactions: ideas, narratives, objects, and standards. Different personality types are better suited to provide each of these elements, and at our mid-year, we heard from over 40 subject matter experts and learned how they apply personality and transactional behavior to their personal and professional lives. The role of the judge, the skeptic, is to provide us all from harm. While many of us would rather dream and act unencumbered, the value of proof, evidence, and standards cannot be dismissed. In our most advanced programs, in fact, we see many great plans start with an inventory of the limited resources very familiar with the judge personality. Here are some clips from the conference.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, welcome to the fun-filled section of conference you've all been waiting for, judges. Hi, I'm Daryl Anderle. I'm the Chief Financial Officer of Influence Ecology, and I am thrilled to be with you for mid-year conference. Maybe the circus intro was a little overt. Maybe the intro was a little more energetic than you might have anticipated from a judge. Maybe the intro is not really what you can even relate to when you think of judges, or especially when you think about being burdened by having to work with one of us. It is, however, an invitation to think differently about us, to think about how we can help your transaction, how we can help your transaction in design, where it may seem totally counterintuitive, how we can help your transaction in production, where we're constantly working to protect you and your resources when your back is turned, and in completion, where we'll always see where our team could have done better, and we are ever, ever so happy to tell you ad nauseum all about it, which, by the way, circles all the way back to design. It's also an invitation to think about how our superpowers can help you in your transaction. What superpowers, you ask? What skills? Well, we bring authority. We are quite willing to be your bad cop. We bring standards. We help define what really is good enough in the production and delivery phases of your transaction. We bring evidence. We'll back up our assertions, and we'll take the time to research what we don't already know so that we can give you an answer that we're confident in. We may not give you an answer immediately, but we will give you an answer. And we bring you security. We are constantly watching your back. And as you test the boundaries of what you should and should not do, we'll be there to help remind you what those boundaries are. And you really can prime the prickly out of us with some planning and some aptly chosen words. Constructivism versus deconstructivism. Constructivism, it's the future. Constructivism is alluring. Constructivism is fun. It's sexy. And often that shiny new idea is only half-baked. And dare I say, it might just be flawed. So after rushing your new idea all the way through to implementation, discovering that shiny new perfect idea is actually half-baked and flawed might sound something like, wait, you mean this thing has to be maintained? Or it could sound like, wait, do you mean this idea brings additional governmental reporting and compliance responsibilities? Wait, that other department wasn't prepared for us to make these changes? Or wait, you mean we don't actually have the resources to fully implement this thing? On the other side of the cycle, though, is deconstructivism. And it can be annoying. You're thinking, for goodness sake, Judge, don't you know we're inventing here? You think, Judge, don't you know it's time for high moods? Don't you get that this is time for celebratory, anticipatory success? Come on, get with the game here. Be a team player. And yet, through all of your cheerleading for the big, bright future, all we want to do is to get down into the weeds. We need to get down into the weeds to understand how the whole thing can happen. We are built to understand and identify the smallest bits. We are built to understand and identify the rules and where the idea will and won't fit inside those. And we're built to understand an idea and identify the maintenance that's going to go into the longevity and making the project work long term. And with that, we, however, are not built to accept the complete disregard for these smallest bits, these rules, and the maintenance that's coming. We fail to run in your fun and mindless glee that most obviously to you should be heaped upon all of your most excellent ideas. We don't naturally come from a place of wonder and where everything is possible. And so you're welcome, actually, because when we mix a healthy dose of skepticism, we all win. And I say healthy, distinguishing that from unhealthy. There are judges out there where truly nothing is possible, and even the process of trying to engage us to get us into some sort of a constructivism mind frame, it's just not even worth the effort. You got to handpick the judges that know how to get up into planning and invention. When we mix a healthy dose of skepticism, when we work together in planning, when you can answer all of our seemingly silly deconstructivist questions in the planning stages, you win, we win, the team wins. When you can't answer them in the planning stages and you don't move forward, well, we likely saved you from running the project off of the proverbial cliff. So we're valuable, yes, but we can be prickly, admittedly. Unlike inventors, we won't say yes easily. Because remember, for the inventor, yes is maybe, no is no. And that's because for inventors, everything is possible until they've exhausted every idea and can't solve a problem. But when the inventor gets to no, it's no, because they have gone through the process and have truly figured out that they just can't solve that issue. So when an inventor gets to no, give it up. Judges, however, will pop off that no. When you come and interrupt us from whatever we're working on and we give you that answer, we will pop off a no simply because we don't know how to say yes. And so when we give you that yes, it's because we can articulate every step that it's going to take to get that thing accomplished. Judges, here's what we need to remember. First of all, and hear me on this one, the world is not a constant invitation for our assessments. Those idea people are actually humans too, and they have feelings. And when we're hurling our assessments at them, it interrupts the process that's going on, the creative process. We've got to be careful about that, because I dare say invention is hard. It takes effort. And we need to make sure that we enter that inventive stage in spirits of high moods, in spirits of wonder, in spirits of possibility, without diminishing our need and ability to find problems and get to the core what might cause that project to fail. Why are judges good at this? Well, what we've been calling at this conference are our superpowers. And each of us, to differing degrees and levels of finesse and delivery, have these skills. We'll be discussing how we defer to authority. What do cultures and countries do to produce environments of authority? When building or rebuilding an environment, what must get constructed to restore standards and security? We'll be discussing how standards give edges. Laws create standards that are defendable in court. What happens when standards are not established and defended? How might standards and consequences add to your true satisfaction? She will be discussing how evidence beats enthusiasm. I know, how rude. However, in many environments, enthusiasm and excitement will not win the sale, produce compliance, or help convince. Where do facts, science, or evidence convince others to say yes? And finally, we'll be discussing how security is surplus. Without security, we may not be all in. Where might demonstrations of security go a long way to create a surplus of valued help? What surplus must be built to produce secure environments? I want you to think for a moment. I was told you can never turn off enough light switches to get rich, which is true. However, you can turn off enough light switches to increase your profit. And so let the judges work with you in that mode of conservation. Let us help you ration out your resources. And let us challenge whether something is really necessary or not. It's done in a spirit of driving profit, which without profit, you're not going to get rich anyway. So, yes, you've got to generate more income, but you've also got to manage what you're spending to generate the profit along the way.
My name is Jeff Miller, and before we get started, I wanted to first thank Kirkland and John for the opportunity to share with you today. I'm grateful for this education that I've been able to participate in, and I'm honored to be a part of this ecology. Today, as Daryl teed up, we're going to talk about authority. But the first order of business would be to level set on what we mean by authority. So the Google machine tells us that the definition of authority is the power or right to give orders, make decisions, and enforce obedience, or a person, organization having power or control in a particular, typically political or administrative sphere. For the purposes of our conversation today, we're going to be talking about the power or right to give orders, make decisions, and enforce obedience. We live in a world of authority. We're surrounded by it. Robert Cialdini, in his book Influence, Science, and Practice, which is a cornerstone of the education that we're in, says of authority that a multi-layered and widely accepted system of authority confers an immense advantage on a society. It allows the development of sophisticated structures for production of resources, trade, defense, expansion, and social control that would otherwise be impossible. Now, authority not only confers an immense advantage on a society, but also within a transaction, which is what we're going to focus on. So in order for authority to be accepted and effective, there must be an environment that is constructed of standards, produce security around an outcome or a state of the environment. And authority isn't authority without the proper environment. Not only does it require the proper environment, but not just anybody can show up as an authority. So today's hearing, or today's talk, We'll discuss how judges are proficient in valuing and producing environments. Assessment is really important. We don't want to accept notions, assertions, objects that aren't worthy, not appropriate, or not going to meet our aims. So we judges will tend to lead with no. That's our first response typically to any inquiry for an offer or request. The reason we do this is we want to see what's going to survive. If it's good enough to survive, it might be worth considering further. So that's why a no is always a maybe with us. We definitely mean no initially, but it's just a part of our standard response. Kind of like that click whir that happens. In our offer at Sound Financial Group, our assessment and authority is driven largely by math and scholarship. We do the math with our clients, and we're always able to reference the scholarship, the research, the laws, the codes, etc., that allow us to demonstrate that authority. Now, none of us like to be assessed, not even judges. We love assessing, but when we're assessed, it puts us in a difficult position, just like everybody else. So I want to share a few things with you today about how to survive an assessment. So the first would be to understand how your specialized knowledge is being assessed by the prevailing standards in the current. Make sure that you have an inventory of the evidence that you can produce. When presenting, prepare your presentation as if you're going into a court of law. So that means having your facts and figures and details available, not necessarily in the forefront of the presentation, but be well prepared in the event that you're questioned. Some tips on assessing an offer. You want to know what the standards are for what you are assessing. So Daryl mentioned earlier that he does a lot of research and review and Amazon checking, fact checking, review checking. So if this isn't an area of expertise, speak to experts about that. You'll find that many judges will be more than happy to take on that type of work on your behalf. When you're being made an offer, ask for evidence of the expected outcomes. You accept that offer. Ask for projections, ask for pro formas, anything that can give you the certainty that what you're considering has been fully vetted. Moving on to you. U is for uniform. It's critical that your uniform match your offer and demonstrate your intended authority. Now, if it does not, you're going to enter into that transaction with an immediate authority deficit. So, for example, for myself, as someone who claims to have reached sufficiency with my money and being in a transactional offer where I help people with their money, if I was to show up to a meeting or present myself with a wrinkled shirt, holes in my shoes, a lack of polish, it would be very incongruent with that offer which I intend to make. So details matter.
Kirkland gave a talk which was really interesting, and he talked about creating career identity requires someone to spend about 10 years in a particular market to create career identity. How many companies have that much cash to be able to do that? So, being a meerkat, I decided it was time to create a community, and that community needed to be a connectors community. So let's define these communities. Let's talk about that. Is my community resellers? Is my community all of London? Is my community law firms? All of them. One of the biggest things that I needed to do to overcome that these judges defer to authority was to actually look at how I could create that niche community. And that market was the top 100 law firms. And then I looked at who was inside of that. Now, before we go into who is inside of that market, I want us to start looking at this for yourselves. I'm going to actually ask you to have a look at your life and your world. Our lens is always sales. So you can look at it in context of your business and how you can go to market, or if your context is a different context and it's about achieving other aims, then you can look at it from the context of other aims. But first of all, let's think about what are those environments. We've had a lot of speakers talking about environments coming towards us so that we have an environment. We are part of that environment. We've talked about creating environments. Is there a community that we could go into? Call me lazy or efficient, but I want to go into that community and then create that community inside of that. So let me tell you the story about Workshare then, this company. Oops. I'll turn me around. Tell you about the story about the company Workshare. So what happened with Workshare, as I went to this market, we identified this market as law firms in the UK. And given that there were so many judges in that environment and their way of operation as standards, structures, policies, I needed a way to be able to actually penetrate into that marketplace. So what I did is I deferred to authority by creating these communities. So inside, so first of all, you talked about what is that community. So I identified that right size community, and that community was the top 100 law firms in the UK. So the next thing I did is I needed to identify who were the strongest influencers in that community. So those strongest influencers were structured distributors. So they had resellers that were selling into that community. They had a little bit of influence, but not that much influence. Then I found out that there were people that I could get who were strong advocates. Those strong advocates were, there was three different consultants that were selling into the law firms. These guys went into the CIOs, the chief information officers, and they advised them on where they should transition their business, from what of their software solutions they should transition their business from and what they should go to. So that was their whole makeup, and there was only three of them. So I very quickly created really amazing meerkat relationships with these guys. So what does that mean? Well, you know what? What do I mean by meerkat? Well, meerkats are very interesting creatures. Meerkats create communities. Meerkats look after each other. Meerkats are constantly looking after each other's back. One of them in the family might be standing there looking out, while another one in the family is foraging around for opportunities, foraging around to see what we could do for the family. And then it might inform another meerkat of something that they've found with these guys. So what does that mean? Well, you know what? What looks really bad for them is when they are asked something that they don't know something about because they're consultants. So I brought them into Workshare and I made sure that they were up to date with all of the latest information, all of the latest specs, everything about the information around our product. I also let them know how we were partnering with Microsoft. So Microsoft being a big player in that marketplace. So I gave them all of the facts, all of the data, everything that they needed. I also told them about who in the legal market were actually talking with us about becoming clients. So again, giving them, armed them with facts. So what does that do? Using the weapons that we've learned about in FOT, I actually created reciprocity with them. I call it, the term I call it in our Connectors Community Program is creating assets. I was creating assets in the marketplace. Then the next people I identified was the people that were, again, these guys were strong advocates. They were distributors. So what they did is they sold other things. They sold other software products that we went alongside with. Again, we made them look good because what it was is they were selling document management systems and the documents were stored in there, but they couldn't see the changes. So when they sold us with it, that made them look good. So guess what? After not very long, they were telling me all the people that they were talking with. So fantastic. I created that meerkat community, which was based on structured distributors like resellers, based on other experts, and also raving fans. And you know what? Now I created the community was doing the heavy lifting for me, which is what I needed to overcome working with judges so that I could borrow that authority. So I want to leave you with a couple of parting thoughts. When we go into communities, we can go in, and this is how I used to go in. I used to go in with an intention to find a sale. I acted like a lion. You know, from time to time, I've been guilty of that. But if we do that, then we're focused on achieving one aim. And that aim is actually not having the environment doing the heavy lifting for you. So what the thought I would like to leave you with is when you're going into these communities, if you go in as a meerkat, identifying your structured distributors, raving fans, and your strong advocates, which are your other experts, then they can do the heavy lifting just like a meerkat family.
So just quickly, who I am and why I'm going to be talking to you about standards. I've been in IT and primarily IT security for almost 30 years. I'm currently working as a security architect in at one of the energy companies in Australia. And I've spoken at the SANS DFIR, that's Digital Forensics and Incident Response Summit, Cisco Live and Splunk Live. In influence ecology parlance, I identify as a judge. Now, for those of you who've just started and aren't 100% clear on what that means, here's what that means. The influence ecology transaction cycle has four moves and four phases, and each of the moves corresponds to a personality type. So there's invent, corresponding personality type is inventor, present, corresponding personality type is performer, fulfill, that's a producer, and complete is the judge. Judge lives in the domain of facts and judgments. And, as we're about to cover, standards. So let's talk about what standards are by definition, because judges love definitions. Something considered by an authority or by general consent as a basis of comparison or an approved model. A rule or principle that is used as a basis for judgment. An authoritative principle or rule that usually implies a model or pattern for guidance by comparison with which the quantity, excellence, correctness, etc. of other things may be determined. Now, in the plural, we use it to talk about ethics and morals, habits, etc. Right? And again, there's that established by authority, custom, or an individual as acceptable. So what do standardized processes and procedures allow? Well, it allows us to automate and orchestrate. So as I said back when I was talking about processes and procedures and the difference between the two, the automation of a procedure, so a task, is changing a password, whereas the orchestration of a process is doing all the things in the right order to ensure that when you change that password, the user doesn't get locked out of their machine. So why would we automate or orchestrate? Well, there's some fairly basic reasons. Not everyone's as smart as you are. You know, if you're working through the night, you'll doubtless find that as you tire, that alertness edge drops off. When you're in a high pressure situation, trying to resolve a problem while senior people in the organization are demanding to know when it will be fixed, that can be distracting. And also, you know, simply people do make mistakes. So automation addresses those automation and orchestration address those problems, but also allow for scale. And I'll come back to that later. And again, back to Atul Gawan and, you know, his thing about, well, what does it allow for? And it allows for the avoidance of mistakes. And then so your judgment is reserved for matters that require the exercise of your judgment. So back to scaling, the difference between an artisan and an engineer. So an artisan is simply another word for a craftsman, right? And both of these are skilled professions. But the engineer approach scales. So in short, I'm not saying engineers are better than artisans. I'm saying there are times when you need an engineer, and to attempt to be an artisan in those times or those circumstances is a mistake. So let's talk about how standards and consequences can actually add to satisfaction. I'm saying satisfaction is the state arrived at with a positive answer to the question, will this do? Standards actually increase your chance of success. That is, having something that will do in the domain in which they're defined. A good example of this is, hands up if you haven't read Michael Gerber's The E-Myth or The E-Myth Revisited. I would imagine almost everybody in here has, and I can't see any hands go up, so I'm going to assume that everybody in here has. One of the things that he calls out is that the McDonald's franchisee process actually flipped the odds of businesses failing on their heads. There was a, you know, you can see on the screen, right? There was a US Department of Commerce study, 50%, so half of all businesses fail in the first year. And within the following 4 years, another 30% have failed. So 80% of all small businesses started in the US failed in the first 5 years. In contrast, the McDonald's franchisees, actually only 5% fail in the first year and only 25% fail, you know, in that first 5 years. So it's essentially just, you know, 5% will fail in a given year. So another question is, what happens when standards aren't established or defined? Well, you get standards anyway. And how I'm saying this is that in the absence of an effort to standardize, so establish de jure standards, you get de facto standards. And one way of that happening is that the standard you walk past is the standard you accept, right? The chief of the Australian Army, Lieutenant General David Morrison, in quoting the former chief of the defence, David Hurley, said that. There's another slightly pithier version, in the same way as a lot of people say, you know, if you don't measure it, you can't manage it. But Kirkland says, if you don't measure it, you don't mean it. The slightly pithier version of this quote is, what we permit, we promote.
My process in creating this talk and really in my time in influence ecology has been one of learning to own my transactional personality as a judge. It's been very helpful for me to think about slowing down to speed up. So slow and steady wins the race for some of us. Standards give edges. That is our theme. So the current ideas about competitive edges are generally not advantageous to the transactionalist. At best, they offer myths that often block inquiry. Charles Sanders Peirce said it best. In order to learn, you must want to learn. In so desiring not to be satisfied with what you already inclined to think. Dewey wrote it another way, that there's a natural tendency for man to do something at once. There is impatience with suspense and lust for immediate action. When action lacks means of control of external conditions, takes the form of acts which are prototypes of right and cult. The judge sits at the back of the transactional cycle with her proficiencies between 9 and 12 o'clock, between implementation and assessment. We specialize in deconstruction, and I assert that we provide friction for slowing down to solve problems. Judges can offer help or harm in the form of highlighting breakdowns as long as we have the facts or accurate information about a situation, and as long as we ourselves are not lusting for a quick fix. Peirce's first rule of reason, do not block the way of inquiry. So you can't always trust the measuring cups of whatever standard you inherited. Conventional wisdom suggests that a competitive edge comes from beating other people in your field, beating out other professors, entertaining students to beat the boredom factor. I want us to fight the naive notion that you have to work hard to achieve excellence. A standard of practice should be designed for the unique you in your unique situations. And that is what's going to give you a true edge or a true kind of justice, I would assert. This is a Lady Justice who's supposed to be blind, but I think you should peek out from under that blindfold. There's an edge that you can get over the unpredictable aspects of a complex situation, like, for instance, in my career as a professor. Standards are assets for the judge personality. The judge personality is proficient in confrontation and authority, and such proficiencies lend themselves well to maintaining how we comply with our aims in knowing. When we think of standards, we often reference the courtroom and laws. Like Lady Justice, they should be blind, but we all know that that's not the case unless you've been being deaf to what's been going on around the inequalities in the world. The classroom cannot, however, be like Judgment Day or a day in court. Students, human beings, what I call my emerging adults, don't work well or function well in a judgmental situation. So what if we use the model of a justice of the peace instead of like a judge in a court? This idea was first attested to in the 14th century. And instead of Judgment Day, what if we're out to, quote, do justice to something, to deal with it as if it is fitting? So the tests and the homework are not about being right. It's about doing what is needed, what is fit to learn to reason well, to problem solve well, not to have the right answers, to test our assumptive worldview and the assumptions on a test. For example, when I give a test, I always ask students to review it to see what mistakes they made so they can predict what repeated breakdowns they keep having, like second guessing themselves, having the right answer and choosing another, to actually keep track of those little faux pas so that you can begin to do justice to the aim of whatever it is. If you're an undergrad, maybe it's getting an A, maybe it's getting a C because it's not your major. So whatever the case, doing justice to our aims to satisfy the unavoidable and inevitable conditions of life we call education matters. It's a little survey of all the kinds of ways you can think about standards. I learned in preparing for this that October 14th is World Standards Day. Who would have thought? Standards, the world's common language. So there are standards like environmental standards, minimize the impact of climate change on the planet. I love this little cake here with all the cans and plastic inside. There's parity, equal pay for men and women, or racial, ethnic equality under the law. There's quality as a standard, the idea of reducing errors, mistakes, and unintended consequences that could have big consequences. As we're learning during this period, it's the things we do not see, the unintended consequences of our behavior that can have the most risky impact. Then there's security. Keep our information in private spaces safe is a form of a standard. I recommend, as some of my expert hacking friends recommend, that four random words is an optimum password instead of something you can't remember. And that's terminology. Make sure everyone understands each other. No acronyms, no jargon. I love this cartoon. We just have to amplify digital, experiential, transformational, social influencer engagement if we want to, wait, what do we do again? Gesundheit. And then there's compatibility, which you could use jargon to say is interoperability, to make sure that the different tools can work together. So back in 1904, there was a huge fire in the city of Baltimore, Maryland, in the United States. Strong winds spread throughout Baltimore and took out something like 3,500 buildings and 30 city blocks. And the reason was that they had called firemen. This was back in horse and buggy days. They called firemen from Philadelphia to Maryland, from Washington, D.C., from New York. They all came over a 24-hour period to the city. Problem was, the out-of-town firefighters couldn't hook up their hoses to the hydrant. So this one aspect of incompatibility caused practically the entire downtown to be burned to the ground overnight. So when we comply with certain guidelines and tactics, or we create standards of compliance, we actually make it easier in case of breakdowns, but also in just the everyday smooth operation of things, especially when there's more than one person.
I believe I know most of you, but I'm Kim Corbett. I'm considered a judge personality, and I live in Denver. I recently moved here. And what I do, my new role, why I moved to Denver, is I am working with GE Healthcare. I'm considered a data software sales specialist now. So where do facts, science, or evidence convince others to say yes? In many environments, enthusiasm and excitement will not win the sale, produce compliance, or help convince. There's a case study that I want to go through where I did a $1.8 million deal in record time. This is the biggest thing that I fight with companies that are constantly pushing me, get your sales force filled out, you have to call on X amount of customers. And I constantly remind them, look, we have to slow it down. We are, especially now, we have to back up. What I did in my career even 6 months ago is completely different. I have to learn now, even I'm studying, how do I make virtual presentations that are effective and engaging? I've taken workshops on that. And I'm taking time for that. I block out now quite a bit of time even to study that. And because the customers really do expect us, they don't want to be sold a product. They want us to completely understand where all of their frustrations, and even sometimes knowing more than they do, because I can predict based on data, I can tell where they're going sometimes without them knowing. And I bring a lot of data in. So I had a customer in Kentucky. It was the largest academic hospital, one of the largest in the Southeast. And I closed a deal in 2 months, a $1.8 million deal. Now, those in my industry at the time, I think the average sale was about $150,000. And I thought, I'm not going to make any money and I'm not staying in that industry if that's going to happen. So I started looking at what was already in play. So I was brought in and transitioning in, and nobody knew me at this account. And so I thought, how am I going to get larger? I had an aim to get $1 million deals. Even it's more of a game for me, even on top of my meeting my numbers. So I started, I was quiet. I didn't even talk in a lot of the meetings, because I came in and it was kind of underway already. And my colleagues were presenting 20 to 40 page PowerPoints with so many different ideas, and they were excited and enthusiastic. And I thought, it was making their head spin. And we had multiple meetings and we weren't getting anywhere. And I thought, I need to close a deal and I need to do it quickly. And I had been in the role just a few months. So I thought, all right, how am I going to bring in some kind of proof? Well, one of the things I heard, because sometimes they even said, how come you're not talking much? I said, because I have to listen to all of this and take it in. And then I step back and then I sit. Sometimes I go on walks and I come up with the ideas. So I started, one of the things they said is, you know what, we're losing about 150 MRI patients from our own hospital-owned physicians. They were sending them to other hospitals. That I figured out, I did research to figure out a hospital that size, their average reimbursement, what it was. That came out to about $4 million a year. And I thought, I'm going to pinpoint one problem, one solution. So one of my leaders said, oh, you should bring this new VP in to present his idea, because he worked in an academic hospital at Brigham Young, which is one of the top authority hospitals in the country. All of my colleagues said, no, we're not going to waste our time. So I called that gentleman, being new, I just picked his brain. And I said, I want you to come in because I have no credibility. He came in on July 2nd. He said most hospitals, so he used his authority. He said most hospitals of that size have about 11 MRI systems in their entire network. You only have 8. You need to get MRIs in here quickly, like up and running by September. They listened to him. I followed up. We had an order and delivered by the end. Well, we had the order by the end of August, but delivered to start scanning patients in September. That was a $1.8 million deal. That accelerated my credibility. The CEO then was a brand new CEO, new thinking. He wanted strategic partnerships, legal entities then. He wanted me to start working with him to build different independent MRI centers. That little action, not little, but that transaction opened doors for incredible growth. Like it locked us in as a strategic partner. And now my colleagues would, a lot of them, in their territories, they would map out like a route in their, like one guy in the Midwest. And I said, that to me sounds like more of a milkman. I'm not doing that. I have to identify and hone in. And again, that was people weren't used to that thinking. So that, you know, that brings it to, that's how I know how to accelerate deals based on the past. And I work with CEOs and CFOs. I don't do a lot of presentations of multiple ideas.
Have you ever wondered what it would feel like to transact with you if you were your own customer and create the appropriate moods when you speak and act? If you knew the answer to these questions, could it help increase the results your customers committing to act with you? We create narratives in all parts of the cycle. And if you're like me, working through the transaction cycle alone, you might discover you may be unfit to transact with the personality behaviors that belong to you. For me, understanding my personality was the difference between having a career and a satisfied career. The evidence was clear. I was unskilled as a judge to transact with others, and no amount of previous success or enthusiasm was going to alter that. My breakdown was that I became a liability to myself through my words, my actions and behaviors, and my body language. I created an environment that made my customers scared to commit to act with me, regardless of my experience and expertise. We live in a reciprocal co-constitutive world where our moods, attitudes, behaviors are all representative of who we are and become when we transact. And as Kirkland and John always emphasize, we are always transacting. Tenakoto, tenakoto, tenakoto katoa. Welcome, everyone. My name is Dr. Lisa Baptista. I live in Auckland, New Zealand. 27 years ago, I earned my Doctor of Chiropractic degree. I started my private practice in Honolulu, Hawaii in 1993. While in practice, I was elected as the president of the Hawaii Chiropractic Association, and I worked together with several university athletic departments to assist in the recovery of their athletes. In 2007, my chiropractic journey took me in another direction, chiropractic education. I am currently a senior lecturer and chiropractic pastoral care coach at the New Zealand College of Chiropractic. Today, I'd like to take you on my journey of before and after I discovered I transacted as a judge, and how by assessing and creating new possibilities for myself over the past 8 years has led to my customers accepting my offer and contracting with me. I used a transaction cycle both in the classroom and during my mentoring sessions. I always start with an inquiry and listen to the adjectives they use to describe their words. I find the words they use connect me with their personality types. It's simpler for me to create a safe space when I know the transactional personality of my students. I have them lead the way, and together we come up with possibilities to a possibility, and I invite them into listening to a solution. I present a plan of action, and we communicate until we reach a common goal, and we go into work in action with metrics so we can track their improvement. And I'm getting really good at it now. Evidence. 2 years ago, I was asked to take on a position of chiropractic pastoral care coach. It means that when students are finding it hard to move forward in the program, they are referred to me. Out of 300 students, I help at least 10% of our student body a year. Evidence. The word scary has matriculated out of the narrative used by my students. Not even the faculty use the word to define me anymore. They used to say to the students, "Watch out for Dr. B. She's pretty scary." Evidence. In the past 4 years, each year my students rate and evaluate me in 5 categories. And in all 5 categories, I score an average of 4.6 out of 5. Evidence. The word I now hear synonymous with my name is wise. The facts of the evidence don't lie. Evidence beats enthusiasm. I've put the questions I started with back on the screen. And as you're reading this, I'd like to leave you with these thoughts. Be curious, find the evidence, and know the facts of how you personally transact and the kind of moods you create. Have specific aims to be fit to transact in your personality and don't be a liability to yourself. Practice, practice, practice. And one more thing before we end. As I started to embody being a gentle judge, exciting experiences started to happen that I'm very proud of, and I accomplished in my judge personality. In 2019, I was presented with the International Alumnus Chiropractor of the Year Award for my dedication to chiropractic education. While I invested myself over the last 8 years, I'm now generating over a six-figure income. Because I am wise and not scary, I am currently in an offer with a fellow MAP2 colleague, Dr. Wendy Russell, to build a mentoring program which develops and guides new graduates to be successful as chiropractors. But the wildest thing that has happened to me last year, I signed a modeling contract with Silver Fox Management. And I had my first photo published in the current issue of Mind Food Magazine, in Bum Huggers, no less. This would have never happened. It's been a pleasure to be with you here today. I hope you enjoyed yourself, and I wish you the best at achieving your aims and satisfying your conditions of life. Nā mihi. Thank you.
Many special thanks to all of the subject matter experts who spoke at the recent mid-year. It was enlightening to hear from some of the best and brightest minds in our ecology. In our show notes, you'll find links to connect with them and all the speakers mentioned in this podcast. The Influence Ecology Podcast is produced by Influence Ecology LLC in Ventura, California. This episode was produced by Tyson Crandall and me, John Patterson. You can find a transcript for this and other episodes at influenceecology.com. This episode is made possible through the assistance of the Influence Ecology faculty, staff, mentors, and students around the world. Co-founder Kirkland Tibbles and our colleagues comprise an international collective of professionals who are active in the development of the philosophy of transactionalism and the discipline of transactional competence. Kirkland is considered a leading philosopher and authority in the field and has authored more than 500 papers on the subject, study, and discipline. The podcast theme is by Chris Standry, entitled Fast Train to Everywhere. You can subscribe to the Influence Ecology Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or via email at podcast@influenceecology.com. If you haven't yet offered a rating or review, I ask that you take a moment, go to iTunes or your favorite podcast app, and let us know what you think. This helps us more than you know.